kind of chance. Thank you. Thank you. And actually, that reminds me that we should do our prayer. I'll screen share. And oh yeah, right. I just have to be co-host. Okay, there we go. Okay. Can everyone see the screen share? That's a thumbs up, Scott, right? Okay,
Yeah,
great.
sorry.
Yeah, you guys are small on the screen. You're big in real life, but yeah. Okay. So let's just take a moment and ring the gong, and we can take a moment to just let our minds settle. And that means don't do anything. Like, we don't have to do anything to make our mind settle. We simply take a break from engaging in thinking about things. Just let go of whatever thoughts are happening in our mind and just rest like that. And then when more thoughts come, we just let them come and go. And if we find ourselves catching one, we let it go. And we don't have to do anything else. That's all we have to do. And through that process, our mind naturally settles. So I'll ring the gong and we'll just give ourselves a minute, say. And then within that, enhanced state of awareness, like undistracted by other perceptions, sensory perceptions, and things happening in our mind, we'll do our refuge and bodhicitta prayer. So we're just letting thoughts and emotions and sensory perceptions pass through our minds, unengaged with, just noticing them. And what we're really doing is resting in the flow of our experience, which is changing from moment to moment, just noticing. We're noticing our sensory perceptions, we're noticing our thoughts, but when we find ourselves getting caught up in them, we just let it go and come back to simple resting in the flow of experience. And we can do this for an extended period as, our formal meditation, but we can tune in this way to the flow of our experience anytime during any activity or anytime there's a gap in activity. That's a really great way to direct our mind, even just for a few seconds. It interrupts our habitual pattern of being caught up in thoughts and emotions. And you could do something to enhance the relaxation aspect of this because we can get very tight about the awareness aspect. Do a quick body scan or notice constructive thinking that I talked about in a recent workshop. Just notice a place in your body that is less tense than another place in your body. Once in Tibetan, once in English. Or once in Tibetan, twice in English. O Sangje Chötang Sokchi Chögnamla Changchu Pordu Dakni Chapsuchi Dakijin In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through practicing the six perfections, may I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken. Through practicing the six perfections, May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Hi to Kate and Basil. Anybody else who's joined us? Hey, Lily. Okay, so what I'm going to do first is, which I would do even if all of us had been at the first workshop on this topic, I'm going to briefly review the basic principles that I talked about of chanting practice. Like, why do we do this? Why don't we just sit and meditate? Because it's really just about, coming to see things as they truly are. How are they like Chenrezig or Tara? So summary of the path. What is our path? What is it we're trying to do here? Our main practice is really meditation. And that is in two stages. You could say three stages. First stage, just take a moment and see if you know what that is. Nobody needs to say it. What's the first stage of meditation? The first skill we develop. So first we engage on the Mahamudra path, like there's different paths. On the Mahamudra path, which is the Kagyu tradition, we train in shamatha or shine meditation, basic calm, abiding meditation to train our attention. To train our attention to that so that we can place it where we want it to be, say on our breath or on the flow of our experience, and encourage it to stay there without getting caught up in distractions. And that training consists of being distracted over and over and over again. We all do this. This is what we do. Each time we notice that we're distracted, we come back. That's the training. So no fault when you get distracted. Your job is only to go to recognize that you're distracted. You don't even have to do anything else. Mingyur Rinpoche really emphasizes this, is that once you recognize you're distracted, you're back in awareness. So there's no process. So it's really, really simple. So that's the first stage of shamatha meditation, to train our attention. Second stage, having trained our attention, it doesn't have to be perfected. Like, we'll probably never perfect shamatha meditation, so don't worry about that. But you should have been doing it for a while, ideally, before you move on to the next step, which is to use that skill we've developed and look at our mind. Like, start to distinguish between, basically, between the contents of our mind, which is what we tend to think of as our mind, and the underlying essence of the mind, which cannot be put into words. It has no characteristics, and you can't put it into words, and it doesn't change. So those are some characteristics, you might say, of it. So first, we train our attention to be relatively free of distraction, to minimize getting caught up in distraction, and then we're ready to look at the mind itself. And that's vipassana, and that's what we're starting to do in our meditation labs on some, a couple of Sundays a month at through Palpeng DC. And what's the point of all of this? Why do we do all of this? We do this because we have taken the Buddha as our example. He has, through his own practice, through studying with teachers, and then through his own practice, he came to see things 100% as they truly are, the true nature of things, which is wisdom and compassion. And so that's what we want to do too. It's free of suffering. The benefit to ourselves is that it's free of suffering. Because seeing things, the cause of suffering is seeing things in a distorted way, like not the way they are, for example, as permanent or as, or through a filter of an emotion, like through anger or through jealousy or through desire. So we free ourselves from suffering through beginning to see things as they truly are, which is clarity, things are happening, and emptiness. We can't pinpoint it. Emptiness or openness, we can't pinpoint it. So that's the goal. So we could do that theoretically, and many traditions, most traditions other than the Vajrayana, do this through simple sitting meditation, like with nothing else going on. But we add a support method. The Vajrayana is known as the path of method, and it's of different varieties of method, but sort of the core method is what we call creation and completion practice, which is the formal name for practices like Shinrezi and Green Tara. And the creation part of creation and completion is that what we do is we see ourselves differently. We see ourselves in our enlightened state. Now, how do you visualize an enlightened state? You know, like, how would you even do that? Well, it has to have some kind of form for us to visualize it or imagine it. So it's given different forms that we call somewhat inaccurately deities. And Shinrezi and Tara are two of those. So we create a different perception of ourself as Shinrezi or Tara, and we create a different environment than the reality that we normally see around ourselves. And the more that we can actually really imagine this vividly, the more helpful it is. And then the completion part of creation and completion is then we dissolve it. Like we do it, we create it, and we practice within it. Like we practice being Shinrezi, or we practice being Tara, and helping sentient beings in that enlightened form, and within our enlightened environment, and then we dissolve it, and that dissolution creates a gap, a very usually instantaneous gap for most of us, in which we might get a glimpse of that underlying nature of mind that isn't thoughts. And isn't images, isn't voices, isn't, you know, isn't sounds, isn't tactile feeling. It's just, it's the Dharmakaya. It's the part of the enlightened state that is free of characteristics. We might catch a glimpse of that. We don't worry about if we did or not, because once you identify it and label it, you're out of it. So we just let it be however it is. We just rest in whatever that is. And then we see ourselves in our ordinary state again. And the benefit of that, as I talked about last time, is that it's very hard to see through our habitual perception of ourself and the way we normally see our environment. Like, how do you get there from here, seeing that as illusory or dreamlike or not solid, not permanent, all of those things? Because it feels very solid to us. So instead of trying to do that directly, we create a different version of it. And we can come to see that pretty vividly, especially if we're good at, you know, if we're skilled at visualization, which many of us, including myself, are not. But it's more than just seeing it visually. It's also just feeling it. Like, I'm Shinrezi, you know, and I am in, you know, the Buddha field of Shinrezi, where everybody else is Shinrezi and it's perfect. We know no matter how vividly we manage to create that, we know somewhere in our mind that it's something we're imagining. And so it's easy to drop it because we know that we made it up. And so we begin, the more we do that, the more we start to be able to apply that to our habitual reality as well. But I don't want to dwell on this too long, and not get to today's program. So basically these practices, these deity practices, are a support for seeing things the way they really are. It's just a different method. But the basic main practice is our sitting practice. And it doesn't matter. We do the sitting, all everything that we do in just simple, plain, silent sitting practice can be applied through a chanting practice. Because in a chanting practice like Shinrezi or Tara, you're also training yourself in shamatha, to keep your attention on what you're doing and come back whenever you get distracted. And you can also apply vipassana, seeing it as not solid. It's not, it's like a dream. It's not solid. And then you can't pinpoint it. So that's the place of chanting practice in the full array of practices. And then I think I've now covered everything I wanted to review. Any questions on that? Because this is an interactive, like a workshop format. So anybody's welcome to have a question or a comment anytime. So today's program then is, was first to sort of give a summary of what we talked about last time. And then we are going to talk about Tara, and we're going to do her practice in a slightly abbreviated way. But first, since we're going to chant it, first we're going to talk about group chanting, like how we do that. And we're in an interesting situation now because most of us are not together in the same room. We're chanting in a group, but most of us will only hear our own voice and the voice of the chant leader. So you can practice with that, actually. We're not really missing anything. So those of you who are chant leaders, in Tibetan we call them umzes, we're going to talk a little bit about how to lead chanting. I think you already know most of these things, so it'll be mostly reminders. But we're also first going to talk about how you follow a chant leader. And it doesn't matter as much when you're on Zoom because nobody can hear you. It matters a lot when you're in a room with other people chanting because there are ways that you can make it easier for everybody and there are ways you can make it harder for everybody. So if you're following a chant leader, and it applies on Zoom as well as in person. Actually, on Zoom, a couple of these things don't apply. The first one, like we chant loud enough to be heard if we're comfortable chanting aloud. If you're not comfortable chanting aloud, you can totally do it silently. Doesn't matter. But there's two benefits to chanting aloud, which one of which doesn't apply on Zoom, which is that it contributes to the group. It contributes to the whole dynamic and the whole feel of the chanting for every person in the room. Like a whole bunch of fairly strong voices is just an amazing chanting experience that we can't really get on Zoom. The other advantage is that when we chant aloud, when we talk, when we speak, when we sing, when we chant, it connects directly with what's called our subtle body, our energy body, the energy of our body. Like this, especially this, we could call it the spiritual energy of our body. It's physical, but it's also not. It's Sambhogakaya. It's the same nature as Chenrezig and Tara. It's there, but you can't grasp it. It's not solid. So sound is very powerful for connecting with our entire energy. So even if you're on Zoom, if you chant aloud, it doesn't have to be loud, but just it engages your voice. It's beneficial. It's beneficial to your entire field of energy. So there's that. So first principle is if you're comfortable, chant aloud. Second, chant aloud, but make sure you're not drowning out the umze. This is a very common error that people get the instruction to chant sort of strongly, and they overpower the umze, and nobody can hear. Excuse me. Nobody can hear the chant leader. And then the chanting becomes not so fun. And it makes the umze work really hard to try to be heard to lead the chanting because their voice is really needed. I think I have to cough for a moment. So we want to strike a balance. We want to chant aloud. And when we're in a group, everybody together in a room, loud enough that we can be heard and contribute to the overall sound. But we always want to make sure that everybody can hear the umze, that we're not drowning out the chant leader. Kate, yes.
I have a question about that, and not so much for our little center because I don't think it's probably not something that we need to do at PST, but is there like I know in Shambhala there was like a rule if you like went through umze training or if you had like were at a center getting oriented, the rule was like on the fifth you wouldn't come in to chant until the I think it was like
It's
the fourth
coming.
word.
It's coming. It's
Ah,
on
okay,
my list.
gotcha.
Yeah, that's a great question, though. It's really important. I mean,
Well, I know I was thinking about our preparation for going up to the monastery and if there's going to be any chanting with Jalten Rinpoche that I want to be prepared for the forms.
Yeah, that's a really good point because, yeah, we will be chanting Chö together, I'm sure. I don't think we'll get to chant Chenrezig together with Gyaltsen Rinpoche, but there may be an opportunity to chant Chenrezig or Tara. I mean, certainly people could join in the morning and evening chanting if they wanted to. So yeah, so first principles are chant aloud if you can, and but don't drown out the umze. Make sure you can hear the umse clearly, which means that other people can probably hear them too, unless they're the ones doing the really loud chanting. Next, always respect the pace and tune that the umse is setting. And that's bringing us to the point that Kate raised, which is how you know how what pace and tune the umse is setting. First of all, that you can hear them. Sometimes we find ourselves, if we're experienced chanters, and this could apply to you guys too, we could be chanting with a chant leader and we think they're doing it wrong. I'm sure it can even happen, at our own Dharma center. We think somebody, the tune's a little off. Or this should be going faster, or this should be going slower. Yes, Kate's laughing. hi, Lisa. Good to see you. So we wanted to know, one reason we want to be able to hear the umse is to know how fast they're going, like what sort of the beat is. And to know what the tune is. And that's one reason we don't drown them out, because sometimes we're not on the same page as the umse, and we always follow them, unless there's a really egregious error. We follow them. And I had such a hard time the first year or so of my 3-year retreat, really all the way through, because our retreat assistant had not chanted in the shrine room, regular shrine room, for years, because she had been in two retreats, and this was her third retreat. As the you know those are She did one retreat as just a retreat, and then the next retreat she was an assistant, and then in my retreat she was in charge, and she had the tune wrong, especially for the morning fire puja, and it drove me insane. It was just so unpleasant. It's a beautiful, beautiful practice, and she was really, in my opinion, massacring it. And that was like a real training for me, and a very hard training, that I had to chant it the way she was chanting. I was really relieved to get back to the regular shrine room when that was finished. But it was really good experience. Because it's an ego thing. That's your ego thinking, I'm right. This person's doing it wrong. I'm right. And you can get really quite, invested in that idea. It can really bring up some emotions. And it did for me. So anyway, we always follow the umse. Exception is coming up. There is an exception to that. But in general, like 99% of the time, whatever they're doing, we do that. Let's see. I just have the pace and tune. Right. I covered all of that. Oh, the exception is sometimes the umse makes a really serious error, like they skip a whole section. This happened even to Lama Norla. Like anybody, when they're in the umse seat, can either have a moment of confusion or they can zone out for a moment and lose their place. Lama Norla used to lose his place sometimes. And what, as an umse, what you have to do is you have to stop and listen to what everybody else is doing to get back on track. But sometimes you don't. And if somebody makes a really, really bad error, I can't even think what that would be in terms of Chenrezig and Tara. Probably fine to just let it go. But there are times when you have to, like the group has to, in this case, overpower the umse. And what we usually do is we stop chanting. Like just everybody's silent, and the umse realizes they're the only voice, and that's the cue, like I must have made a mistake. So then it all gets corrected. And this is just part of the process of chanting. I used to think it was a kindness of Lama Norla to make a mistake every once in a while, because it made it okay for the rest of us to make mistakes. So next principle of chanting as a part of the group is, if you're not sure, especially if you're not sure, so we've kind of talked about chanting aloud, like letting your voice be heard. But if you're not familiar with the tune, like if you really are new to the practice, chant really softly until you actually know the tune. You don't want to be contributing your voice to the group voice when you're actually chanting it wrong. And this, believe me, this gets done. And it can be very distracting to everybody. And I will send a written list of these for anybody. This may not be a big interest of some of you, but it is an interest, of the Dharma Center, because they chant, they get together in person and chant. And we do visit the monastery sometimes, and we want to chant there. And it's good to know the basic principles. So chant softly until you're familiar with the tune, and then you're welcome to chant as loud as you want, as long as you can hear the umse. Okay, so here we get to the point Kate brought up. So in any chanting practice, it's divided into sections. You know, there's the refuge in bodhicitta, there's the visualization, there's the seven branch prayer, there's in Tara, there's the praises of Tara. And so each of these sections is somewhat of a self-contained unit. And so when you get to the end of a section, everybody goes silent. Like there is often a little pause. Everybody goes silent, and only the umze chants the first few syllables. Only the chant leader. We've not emphasized this, so a lot of people may not know this. And we haven't been able to chant in a group most. So we've been doing Zoom where it doesn't really apply so much, but you can practice it even on Zoom. So Kate mentioned that Shambhala had a five-syllable rule. We don't have a formal rule about how many. It's like two or three, and people will come in at different times. It's not like everybody comes in on the same syllable necessarily as they might in a Shambhala group, which must be very lovely. But you let the umze chant the first few syllables alone, and then you know what the tune is that they're using, because sometimes there's different tunes, and you know what the pace is. It's very clear to everybody, and it's really a beautiful effect. So at the beginning of each section, that's what happens. Right. Okay. Another thing, never get ahead of the umze. And that's part of like letting them set the pace. Sometimes chanters in a group and as an umze, like this is so distracting when you're the chant leader, people get ahead of you. Like you don't want to lag behind. You want to stay on the same beat as the umze, but you want to like you still want to, there's a way to just let them set the pace. Their voice is always, I wouldn't say always the first, it's not clearly the first, but you just don't want to get ahead of them. You don't want to anticipate and chant a syllable before they actually start chanting it. That said, sometimes the umze will need to take a breath or maybe have a coughing, a little moment of coughing, or for some other reason, or maybe they get lost. That happens more often than we might think. If the umze stops in the middle of a line, we keep going. At the end of a section, we give them space and let them chant the first few syllables. But in the middle of a line, we keep going, and we give the umze, that's how we give the umze space there to take their breath or drink a sip of water or cough or whatever they need to do. So we keep chanting as best we can in the middle of things. And so that's all the basic principles that I thought to write down. So to recap, at the beginning of each section, nobody chants until the umze has chanted a few syllables. And in the middle of a section, if the umze stops or hesitates, we just keep going. And then they just chime in again when they're ready. So does anybody have, like, that's a lot of information, especially if I'm sure some of you're not that used to chanting in a group together in the same room. So don't worry about it, but I will send a list and anybody can study that if they wish to. And otherwise you'll learn that through chanting. You'll see what everybody does. We always go into like a new situation, like a new practice, very gently, like knowing that we're a beginner and so we're not overpowering anybody. We might be silent the first few times we chant with a group if we don't know the practice, or we might chant very softly. And so then you can hear what everybody's doing. And so it kind of takes care of itself. Anybody, before we talk about the umze, like sort of guidelines for umzes, which is much shorter, anybody have any comments on that? Dan?
I was going to say, one of the things that was actually very helpful when we had our Wednesday night group here in Manhattan is if we had like a person that had come in for the first or second time and we were chanting Cenerentola, it was often good to have somebody more experienced sit next to them because you don't really, you don't, there's going to be that time they're going to miss the thing that says, repeat three times. So we tried to pair up somebody that was new and unfamiliar with the practice with a more experienced person. You could kind of give them the hand signal, like put up three fingers there, or when we're doing the mantra, just kind of roll your hand, like just keep, keep doing that. And that it did help to keep the flow of the practice much more intact.
Yeah, very good point. Thank you. Yeah, I think we probably do that in Richmond too. Yes, Scott, and you're muted.
This is a new question, so finish.
Okay. That's it. That is a really helpful thing. I mean, generally, and I know we've talked about this in Richmond a bit, it's really helpful if somebody new comes, like the first time, maybe even the second and third times, for somebody to kind of be their buddy and just help them, you know, get used to all the routines. Gene, I know Gene has something to say on this, so we'll save yours for sex, Scott. Gene, go ahead.
No, I just want to add, that's a really good point. And if you're sitting next to someone who's new, you can say, just look at my text. If you get lost, you know, you can invite them to do that so they won't feel weird leaning into it and looking at your text, and you can point to the place where you're at.
Yes, very good point. I'll never forget my first night at the New York City Center back in 1980, October of 1980. Let's see, the 29th is my anniversary of taking refuge. Which is Tuesday. Mom and Earl always said we should celebrate that like we celebrate our birthday, but most years it kind of goes by. And I go, oh, right, it's been however many years. But I sat next to somebody, an experienced practitioner named Lydia Saltzman. I don't know, Jean and Bruce probably.
Oh, yeah, Lydia.
Lydia's quite a character. Still around. But, and she, you know, she sat next to me, she was my, you know, my guide, and she would like just point to the text if I would get lost. And, it was really nice to have that. Okay, Scott.
During the mantra or at the end of the mantra recitation, when the umze indicates that we're done now, do people chant along with that, or do they just let the umze finish up the second half of the mantra or whatever you want to call it?
I think there's no big fault either way, but the way I was trained is the umze says that last mantra loud, and that's the signal to everybody to just stop. And so we don't chant that last mantra with the umze. It's not always crystal clear, and there's no fault in some sanghas. I mean, I've worked with sanghas, I don't refer to Richmond as one of them, where people just really like to chant that loud mantra, and so if people prefer it, it's fine. You know, I was trained in a certain way, and I thought that was the way, because that was I never chanted in other groups, you know, for probably decades. But turns out there's different tunes for Chenrezig, there's different tunes for Tara, like there's a lot of different ways it can be done. So it made me kind of let go a little bit of my grasp of what is actually correct. So I would say the way I was trained, we stop as soon as we notice that the chant leader has raised their voice for the mantra, we just stop. But if you want to chant along with it, I think it's fine. And Richmond can set its own rule about that, depending on what people want to do. Good, very good question. I had left that out, but have now added it to my list.
Thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, everybody. Okay, any more questions on how to chant as part of the group before I go on to how to chant as the chant leader?
I have a quick question.
Yes, Stephanie.
So I think I remember being taught, and I'm not sure, Lama, if it was by you some years ago at PST or if it was up at the monastery, but that when we are chanting, that we use, you know, we want to follow the tune of the umse for sure, but also if it's a register that doesn't work with our voice, that we can, you know, we could go an octave lower or an octave higher or harmonize, and wanted to bring that into the conversation. Yes.
I have that in the umse section, but I don't have it in the chanter section. Yeah, that's true. And I've certainly encountered people who when they're umse, I can't chant the same, I don't know, register, I guess, is good, pitch, I don't know the right word, but we'll go with register, which is what Stephanie said. You know, they're a little too high, and it's in a place where my voice won't do that, or it's too low. So yeah, you can harmonize. You want to do it carefully. I mean, it's okay, it might sound a little off the first few syllables or first few lines, and then you get into, like, then it starts to work. So that's fine. That's a really good point, Stephanie. Because what do you do when you can't chant with the umze? Like, voice is just not synchronizing with your voice.
And yeah, I tend to have to go a little bit lower. So I do often, I think, harmonize with yes. our chanting.
Yes, that's time. Fine. And I'm sorry about that. I could never chant with Lama Chunam. The voice and my voice did not match up at all. So I would have to figure out. Sometimes you have to just go quiet because you can't quite get in there. And that's like, that's what you do. You can try to find your way in so that you can be part of the chanting. And the harmonizing is can add nicely to the chanting. But if you just can't get in there, like after a few attempts, then what I do is just go, I chant very quietly so that nobody can hear me.
I think I've noticed too that like the Tibetans do that naturally, like the, especially like between like different like gendered practitioners with different natural kind of voice intonations or whatever the correct word is for how deep or high your voice is. But like I was like next to some Tibetan women the last time I was at a center, and it was so beautiful to listen to them, and they were absolutely just harmonizing because there's no way that their voices were going to go as low as the chant leader.
Yeah. Thank you, Kate. Yes. Was it KTD, says Stephanie. I've talked about this with somebody, and I'm feeling like it might've been Jean, and it would have been years ago. It might've been somebody else saying that what they had heard from the Lama was to try to match them. Like the ideal is that you're matching them, like you're really chanting just like the Umze. But sometimes it's just really not possible. So yeah, there's a plan B and even a plan C, like go quiet if you just can't contribute to the chanting. Okay, anybody else on chanting from the perspective of the person in the group? And if we think of other things later, that's fine too. Okay, so I have, oh yeah, Jacob, were you raising your hand? Or are you just flailing a bit, moving around? Okay, so if you are the Umze, I have only a few pointers there, and I think most people who do that know them. And I want to say, anybody can be an Umze. Anybody can be a chant leader. There are some people who really, really like doing that or are really attracted to that. The only condition I would set on that would be, I think you need to be really familiar with the chanting. You need to have been doing it consistently for a while. Because when you get in the Umze seat, suddenly you don't remember anything. Like when you get there the first time, it's like you have no idea what's the tune, even of the first prayer. And you can forget it anywhere along the line. You know, you could have been a chant leader for 20 years and suddenly you're sitting there, it's all alien. It's like, I don't know the tune. Certainly happened to me. right, I forgot why I said that. Okay.
You're going to tell us about the Umze. And yeah, you're totally right, by the way. It's like you think you know the practice. And then you kind of dry, as actors say, you dry up, you know, when you're.
Yeah.
But usually if you wait a few moments, it'll come back. Or if someone in the room knows the tune, they'll.
Yeah.
Kindly hum a little bit, maybe.
I think it's akin to stage fright. It's just
Zangma did that for me.
Yeah. Who did?
Zangma. She could tell when I forgot the tune because I'd sit there and she'd hum a few, just like a few notes, and I'd come back.
Jeannie, you did it for me 2 days ago.
I got it from her.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's good. I mean, if you really blank out, you can just hesitate. And somebody may know to chime in or to just take the lead just for that moment. And then you get the tune and then you're fine to be the Umze. But especially when you're the Umze for the first couple of times, it's good again to buddy up with somebody and just let them know, like, help me out. Like if I'm not getting it, help me out. And that's the one time it's okay to overpower the Umze. Like if they're new and they're like getting it wrong, you can just let it go and they'll get it later, but it's okay, especially if you have a buddy agreement, like to just help them out if they're getting it wrong or if they're like blanking out. It will happen. So go ahead.
I told Bruce that when we started, I'd say if I stop, go ahead. Don't
yeah
worry for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
When the center was new and we were the only ones who knew this thing.
1993. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's good to our sanghas are very friendly and welcoming generally. There are sanghas, and there have been situations in our sanghas too where people don't necessarily get along very well. So there can be, I mean, this has happened at the monastery, it happens in 3-year retreat, where people will try to like sabotage you when you're the umze, because it's just emotional situations or, you know, whatever, things come up in life, and sometimes people are not so cooperative and helpful, but generally we try to be. Oh Lord, yes, yes, indeed, Stephanie. 3-year retreat is a fabulous training because all of your stuff comes up. You know, you're in a building 24/7 for 3 years, not going anywhere, and it's not people you chose to spend 3 years in an enclosed small place with. And so stuff comes up, and that's part of the point of 3-year retreat. That's part of the reason you don't do solitary retreat. Lama Norla has told us this. If you do solitary retreat, you'll think you don't have any problems and that you've become enlightened. But when you're with a group, the group always keeps you humble in your place. There's always people ready to put you in your place. And it's good. It's really helpful. It's like having children. Same thing. Okay. So my first principle, or my first guideline for being an umze, is lead fearlessly. Just do it. You know, don't overthink it. If you're, you know, if something's going wrong, just barrel through. And if you need help, somebody will probably help you. Or you'll just get through the thing. You'll get through the thing and you chanted it all wrong and nobody really cares. It does not matter in the end. We used to, you know, just another digression. I don't want to take too much time, but, you know, sometimes we would have to do practices like for special occasions that we didn't know, or during empowerments, Lama Norla, or somebody would give an empowerment, and somebody in our, you know, our sangha, usually a 3-year retreat graduate, would have to be the chupan, the shrine master, and they wouldn't know what they were supposed to do. They didn't have a written thing. And so Lama Norla through the whole thing would be really like stern and like, no, no, you know, and he would show us, you have to do this. You know, he'd snap his fingers to get our attention as we're doing the wrong thing. And then at the end, he would always say, it was perfect. You'd go up and say, oh, sorry, Lama, I really messed up. He'd say, oh, it was perfect. So that at the end, it's always perfect. Like just, you just get through it. So lead fearlessly. But if you get confused at any time or lose your place, then you can stop and let other chanters lead until you're reoriented. So, you know, the thing is to recognize when that's happening as best you can, and to be humble again, like let other people take over for a little while until you're back on track. Happens to any, as I said, it even happened to Lama Norla sometimes. Next is what we've talked about, what Kate brought up early on. The first couple of syllables, if you're Shambhala, it's 5 syllables. But you, for us, it's 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, whatever. Sometimes it's just, it's how the chanting is going. It's really obvious where you might chime in. The first couple of syllables of each section are called the ka den. Ka means voice and den means seat. So they're the seat for the voice. And that's where the umze sets the pace and the tune for each section by chanting that ka den alone, the first few syllables alone, before other chanters join in. And this won't always happen. Chanters don't always know to do this. And then it's fine. You just keep going. But it's really beautiful effect if everybody knows to do that. All right. Okay. Oh, somebody's saying something? No. Okay. Next one is chant loudly enough when you're the umze. When you're the chant leader, chant loudly enough that others can follow you. Like one of the worst things that can happen in chanting is that the umze has a soft voice and nobody can hear them. And this happens more often than you would think. At the monastery, there's a couple of people who, when they're the chant leader, it's like you just kind of go, okay, you know, and you're not going to be able to really chant very much. You'll have to be very quiet because you can only hear them if you're basically not chanting. You can kind of chant in a whisper. You have to be able to hear the umze. So the umze, to the best of their capacity, has to do their part to make it possible for everybody to hear them. Sometimes people just don't have a strong voice, but you need them to be an umze, and so you just deal with the situation. But when you can, you just make sure you're chanting loud enough that everybody should be able to hear you. Next. Right. when you're in umze, sometimes it will happen that one or more people, through misunderstanding the situation, will chant louder than you, and you can't do anything about it, and then you just get through it. It's in the end, it's all perfect. And it may or may not be a situation where you can have a word with them, or someone can have a word with them later. Sometimes you really can't. Okay. Right. And this one also, I think this is the one Stephanie brought up, that if someone is over, if you realize you need to change the pitch, if as the umze, you realize that people are struggling to match your register, like how high or how low you're chanting, if you have the capacity to adjust, then you do that so that people can chant along. And as Stephanie pointed out, sometimes I tend to chant in a low register, and I notice I'm not hearing other voices very strongly, and I know people chant. So then I'll shift. I'll try to change my register. And then suddenly everybody's chanting together. So if you can do that, that you can do that anytime. You can do that at the beginning of a section. You can do that in the middle of a section. You can do that in the middle of a line. You can adjust your register to accommodate other chanters. Okay, that's it. Those are all of mine. Anybody have anything to add? Any experienced umzes have anything to add that would be helpful for an umze to know?
Yeah, along that line, you do kind of have to listen to the while you're umzeing, which is kind of hard, you know, because you're umzeing, but you're kind of listening at the same time, at least for the beginning, to see if people are being, able to keep up with you and on pitch, just listen to the room a bit.
Yeah. Read the room. That is a skill of an umze, is to be able to read the room as they're chanting. Like, are people struggling? Am I getting feedback that I'm doing something wrong? Like everybody going silent. That's a really clear, like everybody stopped. So, I missed a whole section, whatever it is. I see Lisa nodding. Okay, so that's it.
Just a quick point too, that it's really helpful. I found it helpful to, and I think I maybe also, again, Lama, you shared this years ago when we talked about umzeing, but to time your breathing. So when you are umzeing, to time your breathing such that you're breathing in the middle of a line,
right,
instead of at the beginning of a line or at the end of a line.
Yeah.
Which is where often most of us, the group, maybe will be taking a breath. But if we're doing a continuous line, or like maybe we're doing the refuge prayer three times in a row, then it can be helpful for the umze to take their breath in the middle so that they can always have the breath to maintain the momentum of the prayer going forward, and like always be there for the beginning.
Yes.
If that makes sense. Yeah.
Oh, that is absolutely something that I left out that I will include. Yeah, that's my training, is that we don't take our breaths. Like as Stephanie said, it's sort of normal that we take our breath at the end of something. Like if we're reading something aloud, like at the end of the sentence, we take a breath and then we read the next sentence. At chanting, that's not what we do. It is what some umzes do. I mean, I've gotten some pushback from certain umzes on this. Like they just don't think that's the right thing to do. So they take their breath in the middle, and then it throws off the timing of the practice, especially with something like Mahakala, where it's just kind of got a momentum to it. If you're stopping in the mid, like between every line, it loses its momentum. Some people, I think, are not so able to do that. And so then it's fine. You just do what you can do. But if you can, I don't really do this. I can't do this anymore. I used to be able to. I think a lot of umzes are not able to do this, and we don't really have the training. But the training is that the umze's voice is continuous throughout the section. You only stop at the end of the section, which means that, like, between two lines, your voice is heard. And that means that you have to take your breath in the middle of the line. And that means you go silent for a syllable or two, and everybody else keeps chanting. So there's really a whole cooperative, protocol to this that you learn from chanting a lot. So an example would be, if I was the umze, sangje chitang sok sangje chitang sok chi chok nam la jang chu bardu dak ni chab su chi dak I jin sok. And of course I have to take a breath now. And I'm not so good at that anymore because my voice has lost a lot of its strength, you know, over the years as I have aged and had various, you know, ailments to deal with. It will happen to us all. Even if it happened to La Manorla, I mean, you can't even imagine his chanting. And we didn't really make enough recordings. His chanting was amazing. And then when he got to 60 or so, you know, it started to be a little bit more, you know, less amazing. Just, you know, it's still an amazing chanter, but lost some of its quality. So that's an ideal to shoot for. I don't even know if they do that at the monastery so much anymore. I'm sure that Lama Norjal does because he's a trained umze. He was one of the head umzes at the monastery in India, Sita Rinpoche's monastery. But that is a very good point. Thanks, Stephanie. And I've now put that in. Take your breath in the middle of the line. And even if you don't keep your voice going between lines, just make it as small a gap as possible. Keeps the momentum. Okay, anybody else? So we have talked, we've reviewed general principles, and we have talked about umze protocol, umze enchanting protocol. And that leaves us now with a half hour or slightly less, which is not a lot of time to go over the Tara practice. So my question to everybody is, would you prefer to do Tara in a very concise way? Or would you like that to be the topic of our next workshop? We'll just really look at the Tara text and we could just talk about this more now for the next like 25 minutes or have just general Q&A, like anything anybody wants to talk about. So please feel free to speak up if you have a preference, and especially, yes.
I would rather spend more time on green Tara.
Yes.
Yeah, that's my feeling too. I'm just looking at the time and it would just be nice. I would really have to truncate it a lot. So why don't we plan to do green Tara next? We won't be meeting next month. We won't have a workshop next month because Galton Rinpoche will be at the monastery and I will be there. And I think a lot of the Richmond Sangha will be there. Yeah, we'll do Tara. And December, we're into the holidays. So I think probably we'll skip December. So it would be January probably, which I think is fine. If anybody, you know, we could probably squeeze one in if people want to, but I think it gets pretty busy, you know, end of November through the new year. People's lives just get very busy. So I will take input on that. You know, we can talk by email, talk with the PST board, but my feeling is probably the next one will be January so that we can have a leisurely workshop on Tara and everybody's like able to come because you're not too busy with family or holiday things or something else. Okay. In that case, the floor is open. Anybody have anything on this topic that they would like to talk about?
Yeah, I have a question.
Yes.
I'm curious about if there's like, because I've noticed like similarities between tunes, like one chant, I'm like, oh, I reckon this is the same tune we use for this one. So I was wondering, is there any like reason or justification as to why we use a certain tune for a certain chant? And like, is there names for certain tunes or, I don't know. I was just curious about that.
As far as I know, there are not names for certain tunes, and it's just custom. I think it's just custom, and different monasteries in Tibet would have different customs. You know, like our monastery, Palpung Thubten Shuling, before it was Palpung Thubten Shuling, when it was Kagyu Thubten Shuling, but Sita Rinpoche was always, you know, one of our spiritual guides. Lama Norla's monastery in Tibet was called Korche, and it was destroyed, you know, in the communist invasion in the 1950s. And then he rebuilt it like he raised money and went over there and rebuilt, the monastery was rebuilt. So he did like 2-3 year retreats. He was in the monastery from the time he was 14 years old. So he was very well trained and well versed in Korche style chanting. And then when Sita Rinpoche would be at our monastery for like a month or more at a time, sometimes he's there for a couple of months at a time, we would like his people, his attendants would tell us we were doing things wrong. Because the Palpung, even though it's the same Kagyu lineage, very same Kagyu lineage, the tradition with certain tunes and certain ways you play the drum and things like that were different. So now we're sort of betwixt and between because we've been trained. We were trained by Lama Norla for like 40 years. And now we're Palpung. So some adjustments have been made. Like Lama Norjal does different tune, you know, for some things than we were trained by Lama Norla. You know, there's certain differences now, but he has not like made us like completely change everything. So I don't really know the answer to your question, except that I would say it's just tradition. And it's really interesting, like the story I was telling about my retreat, you know, assistant, the nun who was like in charge, she was our leader in our retreat, chanting. Different, okay, now I lost the thread, darn. What was I going to say about that situation? Yeah, I don't know. Oh, well, I had something to say. So it happens when you get to your 70s, maybe your 60s. I've been doing this for a while. Just forget in the middle. Anyway, yeah, different. Yeah, I don't know. But even between the Richmond Shunreisi, the way we chant Shunreisi in Richmond, you might have noticed this, and the way it's chanted in D.C., like this drives Marilyn crazy. She's not here today. Hi, Marilyn, if you're watching the recording. I don't know that it drives you crazy, but I know that you've questioned it a couple of times. Like, why does Richmond chant it like that? Because that was the blessing of Lama Norla Rinpoche. And Jean and Bruce can chime in on this, but my understanding is that your training came from a recording that Lama Norla made, and he did the fancy version. Like whenever you ask Lama Norla to make a recording, he'd think, oh, I have to do the fancy version. And it would not be the way that it's usually chanted, which is what you were looking for, so that people could do it on their own. He would do some really different thing. And it's not very different. It's one little difference, you know, like the way it's chanted at the monastery and in DC is Sangje Chitang Sokchi Chonamla. But the way it's chanted in Richmond has a little step in it. Sangje Chitang Sokchi Chonamla. So when other people hear Richmond chant, it's like, why that's different? I wonder why that's different. I think it's
yes,
a
you're right.
Lesson.
It was from a recording by Lama Norla Rinpoche, and it's our chanting and we're sticking to it.
Yeah,
unless someone tells us not to.
You know how I figured out finally many years later that it was like just a different, like more ornate version of Shunreisi is when we were, when the Virginia Museum, the VMFA had the big event, the Tibetan exhibition back in what, 2019? I think it was before the pandemic, I think.
Yeah.
Tempa came down, the monk Tempa Lekshe came down from the monastery to lead us at the museum in public chanting of Shunreisi and Mahakala. He chanted it the way Richmond chants it, and he did not learn that from Richmond. He because it was like a public event, he chose to chant it in a slightly more ornate way. And I'm like, that's the way we chant it. I was really surprised. And that's one of the times when Marilyn was like, what's going on? Why is he chanting it differently?
No, it's not that different though. It's
no, it's almost the same. But if you're used to the way the monastery chants it, it's very noticeable. And it's probably noticeable to Richmond people when you go to the monastery. It's like it's missing a step. Dan.
I have a bit of an Umze confession to make.
Oh, we want to hear it.
I don't know if anybody has ever heard this story before. There was one night at the Wednesday night Manhattan Center, and I don't remember who the Lama coming down from the monastery was, but they didn't show up. The entire top echelon didn't show up.
Oh.
So I had an entire group of just new people showing up. So fortunately, I think I chickened out a little bit because I had Nanda Lama Norler's Chenrezig practice on my cell phone.
Right.
So I kind of let Kim Umze over my cell phone. And I don't know if that was okay or not.
Oh, yes, but I was, it's done. Oh, yes, it's what you do. It's what you do. Yeah, exactly the right thing. But go ahead. Sorry.
Well, I was just like, okay, this is like panic mode. Yeah. I know that I'm stuck there in front of all these new people and forget everything I know. So I said, you know what? Let's let Lama Norla, our esteemed from upstate, let him lead the practice. So I put on my cell phone recording and put it up to maximum volume, put it down on the little table there and just said, okay, this is what we're doing for the Chenrezig practice.
I bet Richmond did that in the beginning. Did you use the tape of Lama Norla at the beginning? Back in 1993?
Yeah, we did use it sometimes, but generally no.
Bruce
and I, when we started, we desperately listened to the tape, just the two of us, over and over.
Yeah.
And took turns practicing being Umze, because we'd never done it before. But I think we might have used it for something like maybe Mahakala or something, but no, I mean I wouldn't think there's any problem using
it. Oh no, it's always fine. You can always do that. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Always can use a tape. The day it was like a Walkman with
And by the time, from coming down, you had to set up the entire room, the shrine, and get everything set up. And by the time I did that, I was exhausted.
Yeah.
You know, so I was like, okay, so what's the plan?
It's running the show.
Up because everybody got up and left. I was the only one.
The plan is improvise. Like, just do your best. Yeah. I mean, you can call the whole thing off, but ideally, you just do it if you can. I mean, I was in that situation one time back in the very early days, in the early 80s. I've been going for a few years, so I basically kind of knew the morning practice, which started at 6 a.m. And it was, it was like in November or December, and we had wood stoves, and we weren't allowed to light a wood stove until like after breakfast or something. It had to be after Thanksgiving because, Lama Norla came from Tibet. You save energy, you save wood. We were freezing. So a very freezing morning, I go up to the shrine room at 6 a.m. as usual, and nobody showed up. I think Lama Norla was away. Literally not one other person showed up, and I was not trained in any way to do it, but I'm like, I'd heard it has to be done. Like, it has to be done. You can't skip a day. So I just started chanting. And I did the whole thing. And it took a lot longer. You can't have breakfast until the chanting's finished. So people started to get up, and it's like the chanting is still going on and it's breakfast time. So then I was on fire puja, and it's like playing the drum like the best I could and chanting the fire puja. And so somebody came up and chanted with me for just the last, part, and was able to speed it up. I know people were downstairs going, on the one hand, where's my breakfast? Why is this so slow? And on the other hand, thank God somebody's doing it, because otherwise we'd have to do it now. We have breakfast at 11. Anyway, those things do happen, and there's no wrong answer. I could have not done it, but I don't know. I thought I had to. That's how you learn. That's a really good way to learn a practice, is to be in that position.
Lama Norla was always happy when people just jumped in. And he used that phrase once. It's like, just jump in, like if you are hesitant or whatever. I mean, right? Sometimes it's going to be a little, shaky, but
I did that once in a completely different context, not chanting. There's somebody had to carry, there was like a full, those big butter lamps. Many people won't know what I'm talking about, but there was a big vessel, like full to the brim of hot butter.
Yeah.
And it had to get across the shrine room. Nobody would do it. Nobody would do it because they knew they might spill butter. So I did it. I don't remember if I spilled anything, but I carried that thing across the shrine room because it had to go.
Wow.
And so then that's what Laman Orla wants. And Laman Orla was there. He was very approving of just like, just do the thing. Like we yeah. all think like, can I do this? Will I make a mistake? Tibetans don't worry about making mistakes so much. They just do the thing. So that's his standard is like, just do the thing. And so he really appreciates it when people just do the thing. Like, mm-hmm. even if you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. I guess that's a good like follow-up question, and this isn't really for me necessarily, but like for folks that are considering, oh, I've been doing this practice for a while, like how do you know when you're ready? And it sounds like the answer is kind of like you don't.
What happens is you end up in the position of having to do it, and then it's a question of, am I gonna chicken out? Because people do. Western people, Sonia Rinpoche calls us chicken heart Westerners. He says, Russian people, they have confidence. But Westerners are like always, no, not me. I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, we're perfectionists, which is very limiting. Yeah.
It's our training. It's not our fault. It's our training. Like we're taught that we have to know the whole thing before we start, and we have to not make a mistake because we're punished for that, you know, or ridiculed for that. Even my granddaughter at like 3 years old was afraid to make a mistake. And she, you know, her parents are not like strict like that, but she just picked it up. Not allowed to make a mistake. So I don't want to do the thing because I know I'm going to make a mistake and somebody's going to laugh at me. Yeah. So we can overcome that. We can override that impulse. And I think it's a really good thing to do in certain situations. Sometimes maybe not. Yes, Scott.
I will chime in as like a frequent umze here that like, you know, for those who haven't done it, it's definitely like a different experience, like chanting in a group by like chanting versus umzeing. And that I guarantee you every umze at your center would love an opportunity to not lead every now and again.
Right. So, oh, yeah.
Just a plug for whoever may be listening. If you feel
go ahead. No, you go ahead. I interrupted you.
Oh, just to what everyone's saying, like just really emphasize like, same thing with even learning to chant with the group. You know, you're not going to know everything when you do it, and the best way to learn is just to do it. So maybe other people can lead some chanting.
Yeah, pretty much the only way to learn to umze is to do it. And when you're in the umze seat, immediately it just feels like so different. Like you think you know the practice and you don't. You do, but it's like the spotlight is on you and everything flees your head. But you get through it, and then the next time it's easier and so forth. And yes, that's a really good point that umzes really appreciate somebody else being available to take a turn. Having to do it every week is a wonderful thing. It's lots of merit, but having to do it every week, whether you have the flu, you know, or had a really bad day at work, or just, you know, just need to have a laid back evening. Like, it's really a gift to the Sangha. To train in those kind of leadership roles. And as Stephanie points out, and the spotlight is not actually on you. Yes, nobody cares. That's like such a big lesson of my life that I didn't get until I was pretty old. It's like, nobody cares. Nobody cares what you're wearing. Nobody cares like what you're eating. Nobody cares if you make a mistake chanting, you know, the spotlight's not on you, but it feels like it. And so if we can get over that feeling and just do it in a completely ordinary way, like I am not doing anything special here. I'm just going to chant, but with slightly different, you know, from a slightly different perspective of like, yeah, now I have to chant loud enough that people can follow me. You know, I have to initiate the pace and the tune. You do have to do some special things, but just make it as ordinary as possible and don't worry about it. Yeah, very good observation, Stephanie. It just got dark. Okay, we have just a few minutes left. I was thinking, you know, if anybody has anything else they want to say, absolutely welcome. But I was thinking we could practice chanting a little bit, like with these principles, like as best we can. And only the people at Ekoji will matter. We're gonna let them unmute and lead the chanting, perhaps. And we will be and that way we'll be able to hear them doing it, but. As Zoom attendees, only hear we'll be able to hear them, and we'll be able to hear our own voice. So we'll try to like let them each remember at each the beginning of each section, let the umze chant the first few syllables. Like even just that part is really, really helpful. So you got anything handy? I mean, I have screen shares. I have Tara ready to screen share. We could chant. What we'll chant is maybe leave out the phrases and the seven branch prayer because we only have a few minutes. But I'll screen share. Yes.
I have a question at this point. In the Tara sadhana,
yeah,
are we supposed to start by chanting Namo Arya Tarare or not? Some don't.
No.
I think I've even heard Lama Norjan say it once or twice, but not normally.
It's not chanted. I mean, I don't know about maybe Palpung tradition it is. Lama Norla did not. There's a lot of things that we don't chant that are in the text, like but look like they should be chanted, and you just learn that. I mean, when I say a lot, I mean every text has, most texts have something, and that's one. That's Namo Arya.
They start with Potala.
Yeah. We don't chant that typically. What I have, oh, actually, I have got the Tibetan. Let's see, I think I have the Tibetan ready to screen share.
And you said seven branch offering prayer and then the praises once is what you want to do?
No, we're gonna skip those.
Oh, okay.
Because we only have like 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
So we're gonna do the Lama prayer, and then we will do the refuge and bodhicitta prayer, and then and we could ask Tara to come, I think, and then do a few mantras and then just go to the dedication. How does that sound? I think we can do that in 5 minutes.
Sure.
Okay. So I am going to mute myself. Who's going to be the umze? I guess, is that you, Scott?
Yeah. Causes and conditions have ripened.
Wants a break. The umze, who just wants a break? Okay. I'm going to mute myself. Well, you can just mute everybody. Why don't you just mute everybody and...
So and, just to be clear, Lama prayer, refuge in bodhicitta, then the Tara practice up until the seven branch prayer, mantras, and then dedicate.
Yeah, that's it. And I'll be doing the screen share, so you can follow that cue. Okay, so Armin, like what we can practice even on Zoom is chanting aloud if we feel comfortable with that, but making sure we can hear the umze. We can do that, and we can practice not chanting the first 2, 3, 4 syllables of each line so that we can let the umze set the pace. And whatever happens is fine. It's perfect. Okay. Do you want to mute everybody, Scott, or did you already do that?
I think everyone's muted.
Okay. I'm going to mute myself then. I shall mute myself.
All right. Om Baden Zawe Lama Rinpoche Dagi Jiwar Bede Den Shugwa Kadrin Jenpo Gone Jezongte Pusun Tuchi Nujub Sadhu So Sangje Jidang Suchi Job Namla Changchu Bardu Dagni Chapsu Chi Dagi Jin Sok Chi Pe Sonam Chi Drola Benjir Sangje Drupar Sho Om Bodala Ine Chugne Tami Jangkule Chungshing Tami Uchi Jo Wa Jo Jo Ma Ko Che She Su So La Dang La Min Chu Pen Ji Shab Chi Pe Mo La Tu De Pong Ba Gun Le Jo Ze Ma Jo Ma Yum La Cha Sa Lo
So I think I said we're going to the just to the mantra now, right?
Yes.
Okay, where is it? Okay, those praises are pretty long. Yeah, okay. Okay, that must be it. Did I pass it? I don't know what page it's on. I think I must have passed it.
We can just chant the mantra. It's okay.
We know it.
Yeah.
Okay, and then the I'll just get the dedication from the other text. I think I don't have everything here. Okay, let me just grab the other text before we go on. there should be a... Okay. Okay, we'll just do the mantra.
Om Dare Tu Dare Tu Soha. 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 Om Dare
Of chanting would hold, or these protocols for chanting would hold true whether you're chanting in Tibetan or English. So when we do when we have the workshop on green tara, we'll practice this more. I'll remind everybody very briefly of some of the main principles, and then we get to practice them as we go through the tara text. Anybody got a question or a comment before we close? We've now done the dedication, so this is all extra. Okay. Thanks everybody for coming. Hi Lisa, great to see you. Okay, I guess that's it then. Thanks everybody, good to see you. And I'll see you next, some of you, whoever can come, for Gelton Rinpoche's teachings at the monastery in New York. That's gonna be a glorious weekend. I've not met this teacher. He taught at the monastery. He's been there a couple of times. He taught there before the pandemic. And he's a younger guy. I mean, he's probably in his 40s now. That's young now. But he was probably in his 30s when he taught there. And everybody just loved him. Like, he went swimming with them in a swimming pool. I mean, it's very – his picture on the website looks kind of intimidating and looks older than he is, I think, because they like really formal Lama Norjal, Paul Pungbe, like really formal stuff. I tried to talk them into using like another picture because we have some, I'll send some pictures, but we're not supposed to use them. They just like formal stuff. So he's very informal in some ways. And I've heard he's so engaging. His English is perfect, like really fluent. And he's just very engaging person. And he's one of those, he's at the level of lamahood that you're going to feel it if you're in the room with him. You're going to know something really special and extraordinary is happening. You can really feel it. And we haven't had a chance to do that because of the pandemic, because, you know, Lama Norla died. We had the pandemic. If you ever get a chance, you know, any of those high lamas. Oh, and before we go, you may have seen in our newsletter that Mingyur Rinpoche is coming to our monastery in May. And it's a bit of a commitment to do this. It's a four-day intensive, practice-oriented thing. You can't come for just one day or 2 days. You got to come for the whole 40. I mean, if you have to leave, you have to leave. But you're not going to get credit for level one if you don't do the whole thing. But Mingyur, you'll be in the same room with Mingyur Rinpoche for 4 days. It's amazing. So, you know, if that's something you can do, if you're interested in a step-by-step curriculum designed by Sita Rinpoche with help from Mingyur Rinpoche, and we all know Mingyur Rinpoche is brilliant at this kind of thing, it's a really great opportunity. We don't know anything about the cost yet. We don't know when we're going to be able to open registration. We don't know much at the monastery yet, because it's never been done in America before, in the U.S. before. So it's a whole new experience. But we will be sending out information. I hope people can come. It will be an amazing experience. And also Gyaltan Rinpoche, like same caliber of teacher. So great to see everybody. Everybody looks great. Mm-hmm. And I'll see you at the monastery. Well, I'll see you actually on Zoom the first Thursday of November. I'll be there for our usual general Q&A. So see you next time.
Bye,
everybody.
Thank you. Bye-bye.